This is Phil Davidson, and with me today is Rockford Symphony Orchestra Music Director Stephen Larson. We are discussing the RSO's Classics 5 concert, Brahms and Mendelssohn, on Saturday, April 6th, 7:30 p.m. at the Coronado Performing Arts Center. The program begins with Mendelssohn's Symphony No. 4 in A, and I believe it's often called the Italian Symphony. Why this name?
Yeah, it's more often called Italian than it is either Symphony in A or Symphony No. 4, because it's probably the more accurate way of describing it. Mendelssohn, at the age of 20, took an extensive trip to England and also to other places in Europe. Spent a couple of years in England. And was so impressed by what he found in England that he wrote what turned out to be the Scottish Symphony and the Hebrides Overture and a few other pieces, very productive tour for him. And he also had the very good fortune to spend an extended amount of time in Italy. And anybody who's spent a good amount of time in Italy during the spring and summer, you can't help but sort of fall in love with the place. And he was the sort of person who, wherever he went, he was inspired to write music. And he did so in Italy. And he started to write a symphony that... there was kind of a little postcard of his impressions. He was living in Rome for the most part, and he wrote the first and the third and the fourth movements primarily in Rome. He was there. He didn't quite know what to do for a second movement until he went to Naples. And as anybody who's ever traveled to in Italy, especially in the smaller cities, has noticed that at some point or another, you get interrupted by a religious procession that's making its way down the street with the icons. No, not icons, but there's usually a band playing and the choir boys all in the robes and the priests and everything, and usually carrying a statue of a favorite saint or something. And he saw just such a sight when he was in Naples. And wrote a second movement that was has this sort of a feeling of a religious processional, very solemn, very measured, very very stately. But the rest of the pieces, the first, second, third, fourth movements, particularly the first and the fourth movements, have a very definite Italian sound to them. Not that he was real happy with it. He wrote it, I think it was 1833 it was premiered, and almost immediately began revising it and still didn't like it. And it actually wasn't really published until after his death. So he never really came to grips with the piece in terms of what he finally wrote. That's one of the reasons it's Symphony No. 4. It's actually his third symphony that he wrote. His symphonies ended up being numbered 1, 5, 2, and 3, simply in the order in which they were actually published. But the fourth is, I think, probably his best known and probably best liked of the symphonies. It has this wonderful feeling of grace, of unforced gaiety. It's just a lovely piece.
Now, Mendelssohn, well, I think you've already alluded to this, but he had a tendency to self-criticize and be kind of a perfectionist. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, he was by contemporary impressions, or rather temperamental. He could get very emotional, very hot tempered about some things. And one of the criticisms I think that he endured in his life and after his death is that he just wrote music too easily. It just flowed off of his pen. He would just sit down and just piece would, you know, before you know it, the piece would be finished. But he was also a builder of musicians, builder of orchestras. He took the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra, which was actually founded in the 13th century or something like that as a music ensemble. It wasn't an orchestra until quite a bit later. And he made that one of the finest orchestras in the world at a time that orchestra building was really some really kind of a new art. That hadn't gotten around to that. He also founded the Leipzig Conservatory, which is now the Felix Mendelssohn Conservatory. So he was very, had this eye on the future, an eye on building things, eye on making things better. And I think he applied that to his own works too.
Can you, you already talked about the Italian symphony a little bit. Can you elaborate a little bit of what we can expect to hear?
Like I always try to say, whenever I talk to people about symphonies, you know, what is a symphony? You're going to hear a piece that is in multi-movements, usually four. And there usually is a full stop between the two movements while people can blow the instrument out of the holes in their oboe and turn the page of the music and wipe the sweat off of their brows or whatever. But actually, he wrote this at a time. He wrote the Third Symphony, his Third Symphony, this so-called Scottish Symphony, intended to be played in one full movement without pause. But more conventionally, there are four movements. Also, conventionally, three of those movements, the first, the third, and the fourth, are in the same key. Uh-huh. This is just what makes a symphony a symphony. Besides that, there are structural things that people expect. The first movement is in what's called sonata allegro form, and we don't need to go into that now, but it's a way of organizing both keys and melodic aspects. The last movement is often in a rondo form or a dance form or something lively and lighter. The third movement is often a dance form like a minuet, 3-4 time, in the same key as the first and the third and the fourth movements. And the second movement can be in a contrasting key, but it's usually slow. Okay, so with this piece, we start out with a fast A major sonata allegro form. Very, very lively, just full of energy, full of just, people describe it as just being full of sunshine. And I think that's probably a pretty good description. The second movement is in a minor key. That's the religious processional movement we talked about. A great contrast, not only in the key, but in terms of the mood of the rest of the piece. The third movement has been called a minuet. I don't think of it as a minuet because it just doesn't have that same kind of a feel. It's a very lyrical piece in 3-4 time with some interesting kind of fanfare passages that bounce back and forth between the trumpets and the horns. But still a very a lighthearted sort of a movement. You can't help but you smile when you hear it. The fourth movement is where things really differ from the tradition because, first of all, most symphonies at this particular time are written in major keys. This, 1830, 1840, now we're starting to see pieces written in minor keys, symphonies in minor keys, but the ordinary flow, the ordinary way that symphonies are made is that if you're going to start in a minor key, you're going to end in a major key. That was the preferred ending. Mm-hmm. People wanted to have the brighter ending in major. Mendelssohn here does the opposite. He starts the piece in A major and he ends in A minor. But he ends the piece in a very, very typical Italian dance rhythm. Either called the saltarello or the tarantella. They're very similar dances, but have a very, they're very fast triple meter, usually yump da 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 dum da 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 dum da 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 dum da 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 da. The triplets go on like that. And these are dance forms that are very typical in southern Italy. He probably heard he may have heard this in Naples. He may have heard this in 1831 during the Roman Carnival. festivals. While they were living in Rome, but a very common, very lively folk dance. The saltarello is called that from the verb saltare, which means to leap. There's lots of leaping that goes on in the dance. And the people like to talk about the tarantella as being the dance that is that supposedly is that people dance after they're bitten by a tarantula.
I've heard that story.
It probably comes more from the area that it originated in, Toronto, in Italy. You know, it's they didn't really have tarantulas in Italy anyway.
Well,
but it's a brilliant, lively movement and really kind of a bracing, an unusual end to a symphony like this. In his third symphony, and for instance, the Scottish symphony, which is in a minor key, he begins the last movement in the minor key, but then changes and ends in major at the end.
Well, let's move on to Brahms now. The Piano Concerto Number 2, which is obviously the second of two concertos that he wrote. I believe he had some difficulties with the first one, and he felt a lot more comfortable with the second. What was going on that caused these feelings?
Brahms is, in a way, an enigma. We probably know less about Brahms than any other of the major composers. That's because, first of all, he was a very private person. Secondly, he was very careful to destroy any correspondence he got from any of his friends.
Oh.
So all we have in terms of knowing what he was thinking are the letters he sent to other people that they managed to save. But Brahms was a bit of a late bloomer, and he had started to write a first symphony when he was 20 years old. It was about 1853, and abandoned it. And later on, that first symphony became part of his first piano concerto, at least the first part of that. And there was age 40, he finally got around to doing that. And it's been said, and with some exaggeration, but still a lot of truth, that he was always conscious of the shadow of Beethoven. Beethoven, who had written, the great nine symphonies, Beethoven, who had written the great string quartets, the great piano concertos, he always thought, you know, if I'm going to write something, it better be as good as Beethoven, or at least as good as what Beethoven did. So he waited a long time to write that first concerto, using that theme that he had developed back when he was 20. But then... waited about another 20 years to write the second concerto. So a big space of time between them.
Well, I think you've already alluded to this, but he did put off composing symphonies and string quartets, but I guess that was because of the shadow of Beethoven.
Yeah, the piano concerto, the first symphony, the string quartets, they all come out roughly about the same time in his life, that he feels finally confident enough. What a lot of people don't know about Brahms is that although he was a very, very, very fine pianist, he spent probably most of his career working with choruses, particularly female choruses, and was always a little bit reluctant in his ability to be confident in this ability to write for instruments. Mm-hmm. So he experimented a lot. He wrote a lot of different things, serenades, before he finally got into the symphonic form. But those two piano concertos couldn't be more different. In those 20 years, they are just the stylistic elements of Brahms are there. You can hear that, but still, they're so radically different from each other.
Is it not true that Brahms described his completed second piano concerto in rather comical terms and letters to acquaintances?
Well, he did that a lot. He was very fond of doing that. I forgot exactly what his quote was. I'm writing a slight little piece. It's totally insignificant. And when he wrote his second symphony, which is the brightest and the happiest, definitely, if you can use that word to describe a piece of music, of his four symphonies, he wrote to people, "Oh, you're going to have to wear black crepe on your sleeves when you listen to this piece. This is so depressing." So he was a bit of a jokester that way, and was constantly throwing his friends off that way. And I think they were onto the game.
In the program notes for this piece, there is a statement that says, "Brahms reworks the traditional relationship between soloist and orchestra." How so?
In a really profound way, but one that you might not be aware of at the beginning. It's probably, if you get a chance, dear listener, whoever you are out there, listen to his first piano concerto, and then listen to his second piano concerto. His first piano just, first of all, socks you right in the chops, right at the beginning, with this big D minor timpani roll and this roar of the orchestra. The orchestra rants and raves for a full 2 minutes before the pianist finally is allowed to come in and do anything. And in that gargantuan, this really titanic struggle between the piano and the orchestra, and that's sort of what it feels like. He still follows pretty much the model that other composers had used. The orchestra states the theme, the pianist comes in and takes over the theme, does his version of it. The orchestra comes in again, and it bounces back and forth between the two instruments. The second concerto starts completely differently. It starts with a horn solo. And the horn solo is entered very gently by some arpeggio in the piano. And it sounds more like chamber music than it does a concerto. Hmm. And it really takes a while before the full orchestra to come in. And all the while, there is this sense of dialogue between the orchestra, the instruments of the orchestra, and the piano. It's not the challenge. You know, concertos have been described, it depends a little bit on the composer, but people have always described concertos as being a kind of a contest between the orchestra and the soloist to see who is going to have the upper hand. And, of course, to allow the pianist to display great virtuosity and great skill. The second concerto isn't that way. First of all, there isn't really a cadenza in the piece, not in the traditional sense. There are many solo passages for the piano without orchestral accompaniment, but there is never that feeling that you get in the classical model of the concerto where the orchestra stops and now it's the pianist's time or the soloist's time to show off how brilliant they are. And in this case, there's also a big difference here. There are four movements to this concerto. The concerto standard for a long time up to this point had been three movements. A first movement, which was sonata allegro form or modified sonata allegro form. The second movement, which was a slower movement. And the last movement, which is usually a rondo and lighter. And the concerto usually belonged at the end of the first movement. I'm sorry, the cadenza belonged near the end of the first movement. Now we've got four movements. He adds a scherzo movement as the second movement, where the slow movement would be. And the third movement, which is the slow movement, is dominated by a long and very, very beautiful solo for the cello, the solo cello. Put the four movements together, this is one of the longer concertos in the repertoire. And as you go through and you listen to the piece, and even if you look at it on paper, you're amazed at the power that's required to play this piece. Brahms was a was often described as being a a very powerful looking man. And he must have certainly had this kind of power when he played the piano, because there are just massive crashing chords and that look like they would break a mere mortal's fingers. He was not known as a particularly, comparing to him to Franz Liszt was a much more adept, fleet-fingered pianist than Brahms was. But Brahms had power, which you can certainly hear in this piece. It takes pianists do not approach this piece lightly.
Doesn't sound like it. The guest pianist is Awadajan Pratt.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell us about him?
Awadajan has actually played the first Brahms concerto with us a couple of years ago. And he played it so well, I said, would you come back in a couple of years and play the second? He said, I'll think about it. Because he hadn't played the second before. And again, you know, this is not a piece that you just think about, okay, I've got a year, I'll learn this piece. It takes more than that. Awadajan is was born in Normal, Illinois. Either or both of his parents were professors at Illinois State University. And went on from there to go to the Peabody School of Music, and has the distinction of earning degrees in three subjects. He has a degree from Peabody, and the Peabody is probably, depending on how you want to argue it, either the first, second, or third best music school in the country, and maybe in the world. He has three degrees from Peabody in violin, in piano, and then conducting. I hate him. You know, nobody should be that talented. He's professor of piano now at the Cincinnati Conservatory and head of the piano department there. He's a bear of a man. He's probably built somewhat similarly to where Brahms was particularly as he got older. And Brahms had a bit more of a pot belly. Brahms was somewhat rotund, but and Awadajan definitely is not. But he is definitely a powerfully built man, and I think he's going to do wonders with this piece.
Well, and we should remind people that they can get up close and personal with Awadajan at Soundbites on April 5th, I believe it is. Can you once again just give us a brief rundown on Soundbites?
Yeah, Soundbites is just this wonderful thing. And we meet at Monotisi Country Club and for lunch. Starts at 11:30. You can go and order off the menu there. And at noon, we start our little conversation. And I talk to our guest artist, and we talk about... We don't talk about the music. We don't do program notes. We don't dissect the piece. We talk about their life, what it's been like to be a musician, how they got to where they are, and you know, what they do for a hobby, what they their interests, and then people get to ask questions. And so they're not that person in the formal wear on stage that flips the tails back in the back of the piano bench before they start to play, and then, you know, bows graciously at the end and walks off. You get to actually see them as a human being, and to talk. They're fun and they're unscripted. We never talk about what we're going to talk about. It all just pops up in the conversation.
Sounds great. Well, the music of Brahms and Mendelssohn will be filling the Coronado Performing Arts Center on Saturday, April 6th. At 7:30 p.m. during the Rockford Symphony Orchestra's Classics 5 concert. And for more information about this concert, sound bites, and more, go to rockfordsymphony.com or call 815-965-0049. This is Phil Davidson.
And this is Steve Larson.
Thank you for listening.